Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk.
I'm Nate Silver.
And this is Model Talk. It's been a little over a year since our last episode of Model Talk, which was after the 2018 midterms. For new listeners, this is not where we talk to models, but we talk about forecast models. Although, I mean, you know, look at us.
Might America's next top forecast model.
There we go. Anyway, we are back with our first episode of Model Talk of 2020, and that's because we once again have a model. We published it on Thursday of this week. It's kind of a big deal. It's the first time in 538's history that we have a model that forecasts the outcome of the whole primary from beginning to end. How do you feel?
I feel tired. This thing was a lot of work, Galen. This thing was maybe the hardest model that I've had to build, to the point where kind of three times in the past, in 2008 when we were just getting started, but like in 2012, 2016, we kind of thought about like, okay, well, we can kind of try to build a real model or do something half-assed, and half-assed sounds like it's a lot less work, so let's build something half-assed. But this year we decided to take on the more ambitious version of this, the full Monty, the whole enchilada. I'm not sure how many more idioms. And it really does try to play out the entire voting process from Iowa through the Virgin Islands.
Yeah.
Does not try and figure out what happens after that if there's no majority. Does not try and figure out a contested convention. But there are 57 contests, 50 states, one District of Columbia, five territories, and Democrats abroad. And they all vote, and we're trying to project out in a sequential way how many delegates each candidate will get, what the uncertainty is, all these contingencies. If you win Iowa, you get a big boost in subsequent states. If you lose Iowa, you might drop out. We have to account for all that stuff, and it was a lot of work, to be honest.
I encourage everyone to go check out the model itself and the methodology at 538.com. There's a lot to read there. There's a lot to explore in the model itself. I'm going to read some of the top line numbers, and then we can dig into the details. So as of our launch date, Biden has a 2 in 5 chance of winning the majority of delegates. Sanders has a 1 in 5 chance. There's a 1 in 8 chance that nobody gets a majority. Warren has a 1 in 9 chance. Buttigieg has a 1 in 12 chance. And then there's a 1 in 50 chance someone outside of the top four wins a majority of the delegates.
I'm going to translate that to percentages. We got really cute with the odds thing last time.
Okay.
But like, I feel like this audience is adult,
just wonky enough.
To be able to handle percentages. And
this is rated adult statistics.
Yeah. So Biden 42%, Bernie 21%, no one 13%, Warren 11%, Buttigieg 10%, others 2%. That's a plurality, right? Excuse me, that's a majority.
That's a majority.
So if you just want to look at a plurality instead, notwithstanding that you have to win the nomination by a majority, then that 13% gets divided up and Biden goes up to almost 50-50 to 47, Bernie to almost 25%, 24, Warren 13, Buttigieg 12, others combined 4%.
Right. And part of the reason that we play out both a majority and a plurality is because, well, obviously there's a chance that nobody gets a majority, but also if there is no majority winner, it could still be significant who wins the plurality because it could still be very likely that that person ends up winning the nomination at the actual convention, right?
Or before the convention,
Before the convention.
There are some dirty little secrets of the Democratic nomination process that we kind of ignore in some ways, right? One dirty little secret is that none of these delegates are actually legally obligated to do anything, right? They are pledged to a certain candidate. Most of the time, the candidates pick who the delegates are. So you would think if you're Bernie Sanders, you'd have someone who certainly likes Bernie Sanders. But the delegates have their own free will. And also there could be cases where, let's say that Biden has 40% of the vote, Elizabeth Warren has 40% of the vote, and Bernie Sanders has 20. And Bernie says, you know, Elizabeth Warren, I like you a lot more than Joe Biden, and I'm going to instruct my delegates on the first ballot to vote for you conditional on making me your, I don't know what Bernie would want to be, right? Or conditional on your promise to pass Medicare for all and not compromise on something that I wouldn't like. And so then all of a sudden on the first ballot, then Warren could win and it would not require a contested convention. And we are not accounting for that. Then no one, the 13% chance that could not necessarily produce a contested convention.
Right. So when people look at this and they see 13% chance that nobody wins a majority, they should not look at that and say there's a 13% chance that there's a contested convention.
That's right. And technically, you could even have a case where someone has a majority, but the delegates are disloyal or the candidate drops out or something. And so
many unknowns.
So we're projecting through June 6th. After June 6th is not in the purview of this.
Not your problem anymore. Okay, so there's a lot of details in this model that I want to get into, but just top line, now that the model is published, how would you characterize the state of the 2020 Democratic primary based on those odds that the model has given us?
I mean, I would characterize it in the same way I probably would have without the model, to be honest, which is it's somewhere between wide open and having kind of 1.5 front runners. It's somewhere in between those, right? I mean, it's on the open side, I put it like that. But you still have, you know, Bernie and Biden combined have almost a 2-in-3 chance of winning a majority. So that's not that wide open, right?
Would you put those two candidates in the same tier?
No, I mean, I think there are pretty clearly three tiers. You have to put Biden in his own tier. You have to put Bernie in his own second tier. And then Warren and Buttigieg are almost tied in the third tier, and then there's a big drop off to. No, I think you know, one thing this model convinced me of is that I think that, like, you know, Bernie has a decently robust position. If he wins Iowa, he looks pretty good in New Hampshire. He actually polls pretty well in Nevada, and we're looking at polls and demographic based forecasts in all the states, and it looks like Bernie has, in some ways, a more well rounded coalition than I think he had 4 years ago, and so the model kind of likes Bernie's chances decently well, but Biden is clearly the favorite here.
The front runner.
Yeah.
The model definitely doesn't like the chances of anybody outside of that top four. And listeners might be kind of surprised to see that the model gives basically anybody outside of those top four a 2% chance. So,
well, I mean, be careful.
Of a majority.
A 2% chance of a majority, because I think if you ask Michael Bloomberg's campaign, they'd say, okay, well, we're going to treat that, I think it'd be wrong. I think you say, okay, well, you show that actually there's a 13% chance of no one. That's higher than anyone except for Sanders and Biden. And we're your no one, right? We'll take your no one.
Like, we'll battle it out at a contested convention, basically.
I mean, I think there are, frankly, with all due respect to Cory Booker fans and Andrew Yang fans and Tulsi Gabbard fans, there are two people who I think would be like, oh, that seems low, right? One of which is Bloomberg. And on the one hand, you can kind of say, okay, well, Bloomberg is such an outlier in so many ways that maybe he doesn't really fit the paradigm for this model. You know, on the other hand, I'm not really sure what the theory of the case there is supposed to be. If the hope is that you're going to have a big mess, well, you know, our model kind of thinks that actually the first four states often work to resolve that mess. They could resolve that mess by having Biden sweep. They could resolve that mess by having one of Sanders and Warren emerge and then bow out and then having this big kind of progressive consensus. Or maybe Buttigieg, right? And so it's kind of like you have to hope that, number one, you still have a kind of multi-car pile up after the first four states. And you have to hope that then somehow you catch up. And you have to hope that you catch up enough that even though you probably won't win a majority because you're playing a very long game, right, that the convention will decide to nominate you when you don't necessarily command the loyalty that other Democrats do in the party, don't have very many endorsements, aren't exactly a consensus choice. I mean, I can't imagine that the left in the country would be happy about Bloomberg winning the nomination. Other dark horse candidate, you know, a case where you have this big pileup and maybe Klobuchar emerges seems unlikely but possible, right?
Is the lesson here really just that if you're polling in the single digits right now, history doesn't have things for you to look forward to,
really
basically?
Our data set consists of elections from 1980 onward, and there aren't any precedents for someone coming back from that position, right? You know, there are precedents for people coming close. Santorum at this point would have had a very low chance in our model in 2016, but he did not win, right? So if Klobuchar has a 1 or 2% chance of winning, well, she might have a 10% chance of making things interesting. She might have a 30% chance of surging in Iowa and kind of grabbing some headlines, but it's not the same thing as actually winning Iowa and then winning the nomination. And by the way, the other problem if you're in anything outside the top four is that, like, you have four other candidates who are all set to potentially take advantage of the failings of one another.
So basically, sorry to say to
Yang, the caveat, we are not totally sure because there's been so little polling. It's increasing this week. We're not totally sure that the impact from events that already happened are fully incorporated in the polls. So that's why I'm hedging like a little bit.
Just because there's been a drought of polling in the run-up to launching this model.
Right. If the next Des Moines Register poll shows Klobuchar at 4% still or something, then there's not that much to talk about, right? Then you're talking about a truly last-minute surge, which kind of happened for Santorum. It's possible, but that, then you are like in the low single-digit possibility range, right? If she's at 12% in that poll, then the model will probably show her chances increasing not a ton, but like, you know, show her more competitive.
So this forecast is going to change throughout the primary season. And part of the reason this is so complex is it's a sequential primary that goes election by election. When should we expect the most significant shifts in the odds of the candidates? Do we know from the model what the most important days of the primary are?
I mean, there are different ways to define it, right? In terms of what does the model expect to produce the largest bounce, it's everything combined on Super Tuesday is the largest bounce, right? And in fact, people kind of underestimate like the fact that you do get bounces later in the calendar. There's even some evidence that like the early state bounces are fading a bit, whereas these later bounces kind of are pretty important. But Iowa sets everything else up, right? Like we have conditional probabilities that we aren't publishing that show, you know, conditional on winning Iowa, Biden's like 85% to win. And if he loses it, he's like 25%, right? Or 30% or something. So that's a pretty dramatic swing. And because it comes first, it probably is the single most influential thing. Certainly an Iowa poll will have more impact on the model than anything else. I guess California polls matter a fair bit, both because we're talking about it being a fair number of delegates, and that could kind of dictate the media narrative about who won Super Tuesday. You know, I'm actually not sure. We had a poll come out this morning in New Hampshire that didn't move the model that much. So maybe New Hampshire is like a kind of, in a weird way, it's pretty likely that whoever wins Iowa will win New Hampshire, because New Hampshire is very much like a four-way race. And in a weird way, that kind of like dulls its impact a little bit, I think. It's like a magnifier on whoever wins Iowa, but like having been through this process a few times and kind of the way, I guess the model probably is, you know, that's one reason why like Bernie, for example, is Bernie would, I think, be very likely to follow up a Iowa win with a New Hampshire win. But narrative-wise, I kind of think that New Hampshire could wind up being like a little bit of an afterthought.
We'll see. I have wonkier questions to get to in all of this, so stick around, everybody. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Quip. The makers of the Quip electronic toothbrush want you to know the one single discovery that matters most for your dental care. It's simply this, that if you have good habits, you're basically good. Quip makes that simple, starting with an electric toothbrush, refillable floss, and anti-cavity toothpaste. Quip's electric brush has sensitive sonic vibrations with a built-in timer and 30-second pulses to guide a full and even clean. Plus, Quip delivers fresh brush head, floss, and toothpaste refills to your door every 3 months with free shipping, so your routine is always right. Join over 3 million healthy mouths and get Quip today, starting at $25. And if you go to getquip.com/538 right now, you'll get your first refill for free. That's your first refill free at getquip.com/538, spelled getquip.com/538. The numbers, not the letters. Quip, the good habits company. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Lightstream. The holidays are over and it's a brand new year. If you're thinking about the high interest credit cards you used over the holidays and the bills that will be coming, here's an idea to ease your mind. Pay off your credit card balances and save with a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream. Roll multiple credit card payments into just one payment at a lower fixed rate. Lightstream's credit card consolidation loans have rates as low as 5.95% APR with AutoPay. Plus, there are absolutely no fees, no application fees, no origination fees, no transaction fees, and no prepayment penalties. Just for 538 listeners, apply now to get a special interest rate discount. The only way to get that discount is to go to lightstream.com/538. That's lightstream.com/538. Subject to credit approval, rate includes 0.5% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/538 for more information. All right, now it's time to get into the messy data of all of this. But first, I do want to ask, we haven't put together a forecast model for a primary before from front to back. You said we kind of half-assed it in the past. Why are we doing it this time?
I don't know. Why the f*** not, dude? YOLO. I mean, partly because, like, I don't know. It's kind of work that I find interesting.
Did you say YOLO?
Yeah. I'm not sure I realized quite how much work it would be. Part of it is, like, I think we've learned kind of the hard way that, like, having a half-assed forecasting product is not necessarily any better, right?
Than having none at all.
There is this. This is going to send shockwaves through the model talk world.
I'm bracing myself.
Okay. Simplicity is overrated in one sense, right? Like, people have this sophomoric concept that, like, models should be simple. Well, no, actually, models should resemble the real world, and the primary process is inherently complex. You have multiple candidates, and you have sequential outcomes where, you know, you can't just ignore the Iowa bounce and try to model the primary, right? You can't just ignore the fact that candidates can drop out, and that can severely affect the chance of someone getting a majority of delegates and whatever else. And so, like, you know, you can't really do justice to the primaries without having a pretty complex setup in your model. And so, you know, are we better off, like, putting half as much work in, but then having a model that we're constantly apologizing for? It's like, oh, well, here's our forecast in Nevada, but it doesn't actually count for Iowa. And so then what's it doing, right? I mean, and if you have no model at all, then you get into kind of subjective territory where probably your own biases and predilections creep in and stuff. And so it's kind of like, I don't know.
This may be another way of asking the question, what is the benefit of having this model over and above polling averages? Because in large part, we've been relying on polling averages until now, and we published our polling averages as well. So what does this give us that polling averages won't be able to give us?
Well, for one thing, there are quite a few states where you don't have polling averages. You know, for another thing, polling averages themselves don't really account for uncertainty. So let's say that in Nevada, what do the polls say? Bernie at 20 and Biden at 30 and Warren at 15 or whatever, right? Even in the absence of the Iowa bounce thing, it's still an obvious kind of how much of a favorite Biden would be in that case. And so you are able to quantify uncertainty in that way. Also, like, kind of thinking through all the different scenarios that can evolve is probably a little bit more than people can keep track of mentally, where you can say, oh, well, I can see, you know, Buttigieg winning Iowa, and then if he wins Iowa, he could win New Hampshire, and then if he wins New Hampshire, then who knows, right? Well, I mean, like, there's a lot of, like, very kind of imprecise thinking there, right? What are his chances of winning Iowa? What are his chances of winning New Hampshire conditional on winning Iowa? How much of a bounce does that get? Is enough for him to not get totally decimated in the South, where he's not strong among African-American voters, right? Like, actually kind of going through that process in a more rigorous way, I think, is useful. I mean, weirdly enough, like, I would say, I think the model actually probably matches people's intuitions for the most part. Mm-hmm. Except maybe I think people want to assume that Bloomberg, Klobuchar et al. Have a better chance than we give them in the forecast. We talked about those cases a little bit. But I haven't seen that many people just this morning be like, oh my God, this seems way off.
In order to create the model, did you basically kind of lay out all of the unknowns, all of the variables over the span of, what, 5 months, and then code them? I mean, what's even the process for creating a model for something as unruly and chaotic as a sequential primary and not just a general election date?
I mean, I think you're kind of thinking in the back of your head a lot about, like, kind of how would I build this and kind of what steps do I need. The rest of the 538 team, this is really a group effort, did most of the data collection. We actually collected a fair amount of data 4 years ago, but, you know, it's not even like, so the challenge here is not so much about the data collection component. There's kind of only a finite amount of data that's available on the primaries, really. You know, it's not a case like the midterm model where there are like seven different fundamentals variables and four different versions of the model and three different chambers that we're forecasting and three different versions. You know, it's just like, it's not like that. It's more like, okay, how do we take this data and ask good empirical questions of it? How do we set up the math behind the model? So it kind of was like, I mean, I always knew what I wanted to do, but the question is, can you actually figure out the math behind it, the programming behind it, you know, which is kind of a fairly challenging problem.
I mean, what was the most difficult problem you had to solve in creating the model?
I mean, I don't think there were many easy problems, right? I thought it'd be hard to, like, figure out how the DNC actually delegate rules work, but those are fairly straightforward. But like everything was kind of hard because you're dealing with a lot of nonlinearity.
Nonlinearity in this context meaning?
Meaning you can have sudden swings in the polls that you have to model, that you have lots of funky asymmetric distributions. So let's look at Klobuchar, for example, right? She's currently in our forecast. Let me look this up since we actually have the forecast live. So Klobuchar currently is forecast to get 5% of the vote in Iowa. But there's a chance that she'll get 20%, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or 30%. It's not high, but it's not zero. If she surges, it's kind of what Santorum did. He went from like 5 to 22 or whatever. So how do you model that? Well, usually in statistics, you use like what's called a normal distribution, which means that like it's a bell curve. You may be familiar with it, where it's symmetric. The problem with this is you can't have a symmetric distribution if you're at 5%, because you can get 20% if you do better than expected. You can't get negative 15%, though. And so even just kind of basic stuff like that, where like you have to use what we call a beta distribution that accounts for these asymmetries. And that introduces some complications, right? You have to consider like, okay, well, if Klobuchar surges, then where does her support come from? You could assume it comes evenly from each candidate. We do not assume that. We actually assume that there is like kind of ideological space and there's proximity between different candidates. So we would assume that Klobuchar, because she overlaps more with like Biden and Buttigieg, would take more of her support from those two than she would from, say, Sanders. And so the scenarios where Klobuchar does well in our model are probably bad news for like Mayor Pete, and maybe actually okay news for Bernie.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's trying to simulate all those dynamics in a relatively complex way.
I'll just make an aside here for listeners that if this is sounding all very complex, know that this is our first episode of Model Talk, and there will be others, and we'll answer your questions and we'll dig deeper into all of this. On the topic of the uncertainty of polling error, we've talked plenty about how primary polls are pretty uncertain as far as polling goes. They can be prone to pretty big errors. Everybody probably remembers Sanders' win in Michigan being, you know, a double-digit polling error, for example. How does the model account for that kind of uncertainty in primary polling?
Well, it assumes that there are really wide distributions, right? So right now in Iowa, the model's confidence range, which only covers 80% of the cases, not even 100%, for Biden runs between 5% and 50%. So it's really not very confident at all. It will become more confident in the final couple of weeks before Iowa and when we get more polling data, right? So here it's basically saying like, well, I have no idea at all what's happening in Iowa because we only have one poll over the past 2 months in Iowa, right? So, you know, once it gets a bit more data, then those ranges will narrow some, maybe even quite a bit. But the thing is, in like a caucus, there's only so close you can get. In a primary, especially like a primary in like a big, robust, diverse state, diverse states are easier to poll because if you f*** up among one group of voters, you sometimes get lucky and miss in the opposite direction for a different group of voters, mm-hmm. right? You can base more off your demographic, your turnout model, and so forth. So, you know, our forecast of the Florida primary, if there are seven polls there the night before the election there, might be fairly precise, right? But Iowa, which is a caucus, a month out with like basically no polling, I mean, like no one has any idea, really.
Mm-hmm.
Within some boundaries, right? You're probably not going to have Tom Steyer win Iowa, although who knows? You could have Klobuchar win. We do give her a 3% chance of winning Iowa without any new polls recently, right? And if she does kind of improve in those polls like she has in some of the New Hampshire polls, then maybe that will go up. But like there's a lot we don't know, and things kind of will hone in the future. But usually you kind of get this like big climactic buildup of polling, and like if we don't get that, then there's no solution apart for the model to account for higher uncertainty.
For states where we don't have much polling, what data does the model rely on in order to forecast how the election will turn out?
So we basically run a analysis based on demographics and geography. The demographics are the ones that get more weight in the model. So basically we take all the states where we do have polling and try to back out from that which demographic characteristics influence kind of which candidates are doing well where, right? So pretty clearly, the most obvious divide is that Biden is doing well among states with diverse racially populations, meaning large black populations, kind of in the South, in more conservative states. Sanders and Warren and Buttigieg, in different ways from one another, are doing well among wider states, especially in the Northeast. Warren and Sanders, but not Buttigieg, seem to be doing fairly well out west, where you have a mix of kind of white progressives and Hispanics. Those seem to be okay states for Sanders in particular. So, but you can infer from demographics kind of what the basic outlines are of where candidates' strengths and weaknesses are.
And apply those to states where you don't have the polling.
That's right, yeah. The other method is somewhat simpler, which is you just kind of take national polls and you kind of adjust them for geography, so candidates have kind of home state and home region effects. That's kind of the really naive default, right? Just be, okay, well, take the national polls, but assume that Bernie does better in New England. That's not a very robust method, but it gives you some type of backup plan. And there are home state effects that you have to account for. I mean, definitely there is like regionalism in the U.S. primary system.
In beginning to wrap up here, in the methodology that you published today, you say that there are four things you want people to keep in mind as they use this model over the coming months. You said the first is it's a forecast, not an estimation of what would happen today. Is that self-explanatory? Do you want to say anything more about that?
Yeah. So if you look at our forecast, for example, in California, I think California is a state, for example, where Warren has done fairly well. You can kind of see her being a good California candidate. And if you kind of look at our forecast there, it seems like Warren is further off the mark than you would think. The reason is that we do not have Warren winning Iowa and New Hampshire all that often. She has a shot, right? And therefore, she may have dropped out by the time California votes. Whereas Biden and Bernie are more likely to have still been in the running at that point. So therefore, there's a forecast that accounts for kind of upstream effects before you hit a primary, meaning bounces from previous states and candidates dropping out. So therefore, it's not a snapshot of what you are looking at today.
I think another example was Biden having something like a 60% chance of winning Delaware.
Right. I mean, if you held the Delaware primary today, Biden would be guaranteed to win probably, right?
Yeah.
But because it comes really late in the process, then, you know, there's a 40% chance that Biden will have dropped out by then or will be extremely feeble. And there's a chance that Sanders won't win Vermont, right? It's low, but that could happen. And so it's accounting for all these contingencies.
So the next thing to keep in mind is our forecast is probabilistic. The degree of uncertainty in the primaries is high and the process is path dependent and nonlinear. I think we've spent a lot of time talking about that.
We've talked about this a lot, yeah. But, you know, when you see a distribution, your kind of visualization, again, of this bell curve may not apply. In fact, it can almost be the opposite, where it's like a binary thing, where either, you know, Wisconsin's a pretty good state for Sanders, for example, right? Either Sanders will be doing pretty well in Wisconsin, or he'll have, like, dropped out. You know what I mean? There's, like, not a lot of in-between where he gets, like, 12% of the vote there. He either gets kind of, like, zero or, like, 30, you know? And so we tried to visualize that as we can in the wonderful interactive that my colleagues made. But keep in mind that just kind of literally, like, the visualization of this is a little bit more complicated, where it's, like, kind of forking paths, right, and not your typical kind of bell curve.
Listeners, you gotta spend some time digging
you
into
this
model.
Open your minds, man.
Take acid before you look at the forecast model. Okay, the next is the third one out of four is our model forecasts the chance of winning the plurality and majority. So there are two different settings. You can either look at the odds of a candidate winning the plurality or the majority of pledged delegates. It's not a forecast of the nomination per se. We cover that pretty solidly earlier. Because we don't try to tell people what would happen if there was a contested convention. Our forecast ends on June 7th.
June 6th in the Virgin Islands.
In the Virgin Islands. We should all go to the Virgin Islands.
We should probably go to
them. Celebrate the end of primary season. And then lastly, the fourth thing to keep in mind is the primary model is complex, which is not entirely a good thing. Why isn't it a good thing?
Well, I mean, for one thing, the more complex something is, the easier it is to f*** up.
Fair enough.
And the more consequential the ups can be. Are we bleeping this out or I don't know?
We'll see.
Model talk is rated R. you know, if you're simulating a process in an iterative way and you have a setting wrong, then it'll kind of keep feeding back on that mistake. And I don't know, right? So there's stuff like that. The math is just more challenging, right? There's even the kind of possibility of what you can call like emergent behavior, right? Where like kind of it's reacting to
just takes on a life of its own.
I mean, it's probably not that complicated, right?
You built Frankenstein.
but a little bit, right? It does assume that, like, because it does these things based on kind of how proximate it thinks the candidates are to one another. And so let's say you wind up with Buttigieg versus Bernie. They're kind of in opposite corners. Buttigieg is running as a moderate. Bernie is obviously liberal. Buttigieg is a very college-educated base. Sanders' base actually has like a lot of non-college voters as well as college students. So they kind of might not actually kind of trade votes with one another that much. It might be a very stable campaign, right? Whereas, like, let's say instead you end up with Warren and Sanders, Buttigieg and Klobuchar, right? I mean, then there's not much difference between those two candidates, so therefore you might have a more topsy-turvy kind of race.
So do you want people to think of this as like an experiment? We've never done this before. Kind of hang with us. We'll talk about it all together on Model Talk as we go through it. Or you're like, you know, this is the best that I got. This is your forecast model.
I mean, what do we usually say? It's better than all the other bullshit, right?
I'll take it.
I mean, it's, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, we obviously are trying to hedge like a little bit here. I feel pretty darn good about both the process of this model and also kind of like, it is relieving when you kind of first run it through actual data that like it's publishing something which
seems credible.
Seems credible.
Yeah.
Because like, let's say we had run the model and actually this happened, right? The very first run of the model.
Tulsi Gabbard won.
Well, it had Biden at 70% and then everyone else tied at like 7% each, including Tulsi, right? And the reason why is that somehow the step in the model was supposed to input national polls wasn't working. So it was starting everyone at zero. I don't know why it had Biden doing better, right? So that was bad, right? But, you know, but if you'd had a case where, let's say it had Mayor Pete as the favorite or something, right? I mean, you'd have to kind of go back and quadruple check things. Like, hey, did I have kind of the Iowa bounce tuned too high? Actually, one thing we did, you know, we try not to do very much like kind of post facto work on the model, right? The idea is that you test the model and you calibrate it based on past results. You don't actually know what it's going to look like in 2020 until really very late in the process. And then you would just want to avoid tinkering with things because then you get kind of results oriented. We did notice that like it was actually like being a little too aggressive about Iowa. We went back and looked and said, okay, we actually kind of had Iowa, the bounce tuned too high in Iowa relative to what it should be empirically. So that was one thing that we had to look at again. But for the most part, the initial setup of the model worked pretty well. And like it kind of from the get-go was producing fairly sensible results, both in past campaigns when we tested it and in this election.
Among all of these different factors that you've accounted for, is there any one in particular that gives you the most anxiety going forward to see how it turns out?
I mean, I guess I worry about a couple of things, right? One is I kind of worry, like, what if, like, we're in a different political climate now and, like, the bounces aren't what they used to be? Like, I don't think we have them tuned too high. I think, in fact, in an open-ended election like this, you should expect fairly big bounces. If you came to me in 3 months and said your model didn't do a great job, I would think I would guess that it had the bounces tuned too high and not too low. Mm-hmm. If the bounces are lower in reality than the model has them, then that would be good for Biden and bad for Buttigieg, basically. They're the ones who are most affected by that. You know, I worry a little bit about Klobuchar and Bloomberg. I wouldn't worry if Klobuchar is still at 6% in the Des Moines Register poll, then that seems very sensible, right? But, you know, I wish we had had a couple more early state polls. We're still kind of frozen in amber kind of from this December debate, waiting for kind of things that may already be priced into the polls but aren't reflected yet. So that's slightly annoying, right? And then Bloomberg is like such a weird outlier in some ways where I worry about that a little bit. You know, I worry about kind of when we start getting in data, kind of I worry about the model fluctuating a lot where we overestimate or underestimate bounces. I worry a lot about like
when the elections actually start happening.
Yeah. We actually haven't built that part of the code yet, right? The code that involves like what happens when you actually have real data. We built that for past elections, right?
Yeah.
But we haven't updated that for 2020 yet. But I worry that like also cases where what if there's ambiguity about
who won?
Who wins, right?
Well, Iowa's potentially going to be a mess. Iowa
also has
we're getting potentially three sets of results.
Three sets of results, right? You've had a lot of disputed outcomes recently. California, you have very late returns that come in, right? And so kind of, frankly, I haven't even thought about what we're going to do if, like, it's unclear who's won on election night in California. So I worry a little bit about that. Sanders fans might not love this part. I wonder a little bit what happens if Sanders is perceived as a very clear front runner or a very clear quote unquote threat to the establishment. We kind of saw that that didn't go super great for Warren back in the late summer. And I kind of wonder what happens to Sanders if he does really well, which is very, very possible in Iowa and New Hampshire and Nevada. I kind of wonder if, like, because we don't make very strong assumptions, right? We're like, okay, well, look, he is in a pretty robust position. We don't make any assumptions really about
like the party decides
ceilings or floors, right? We put a very weak weight. The model, let's look at fundamentals. It puts a very weak weight on non-polling factors, right? So it looks at endorsements. It looks at fundraising also, though, and fundraising, of course, helps Sanders. But, like, you know, that might not quite illustrate the kind of specific case of could the Democratic establishment trigger a panic over Sanders that could result in various things, right? I mean, you know, one thing is, like, we assume that candidates kind of choose to drop out in line with historical data, right? And they aren't thinking about, like, the kind of narrative about the race. Well, let's say that the establishment thinks it's really important to throw roadblocks up to Bernie, right? Maybe a model that says, okay, well, ordinarily, Biden couldn't win the nomination, and he'd only be a spoiler to kind of send it to a contested convention, and so why would he stay in the running when he can't actually win it himself once you go to the floor, and it's really messy, right? Kind of like how Ted Cruz and John Kasich eventually bowed out in 2016, right? Actually, that's a good precedent for someone like Bernie.
So clearly a lot on your mind in terms of how this is all going to play out and how the model's going to react to it all. And thank you for being somewhat blunt, somewhat honest there about whatever anxiety this model may be creating for you, whatever questions remain.
I put it like this, right? Because you have a sequential process, that gives people time to react to the process. If you had the general election in 2016 occur sequentially and Michigan votes on, what was the election day, November 6th or whatever, right? On November 6th, and Trump wins Michigan, and then Wisconsin votes a week later, well, all of a sudden, a lot would change, right? The polls would change, and, like, Democrats might turn out more in Wisconsin, and Hillary might campaign there and whatever else, right? And so, you know, so whenever people have the time to opportunity to kind of react to past results and change their behavior, that's potentially, like, throws a few
very complicated wrinkles
in. By the way, on the flip side, if I were Biden, I would worry about, well, okay, because we do believe actually in lanes to some extent, I would worry about, okay, well, what happens if Bernie and Warren combine forces in some order? Mm-hmm. That would worry me if I were anyone that's not Bernie or Warren. So those are all things worth thinking about.
Let's leave it there. Thank you so much, Nate. Get some sleep.
I'll try. Thank you.
If you have any questions, listeners, for a future episode of Model Talk, send them our way either on Twitter or at podcasts@538.com. Also, if you have not yet listened to the first episode of The Primaries Project, go check it out. It's right below this podcast in our feed. In the run-up to Iowa, we're looking at why we have the nominating system we have and what its consequences are. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Really, actually, tell a friend, you know, your neighbor. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.